Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is Groundhog Day of 57. And delighted, ain't that bad. Just sounds awful. I am delighted to see you. And our workshop, our theme, a simple kit of spiritual tools. That's we're supposed to say that. That's the party line. So I got that out of the way. And we'll focus on one area that may be called a tool shed. I forgot my topic. Oh, can I see the program? Greg, yeah, you're a wonderful person. You just licked on it, spit on it. He just no class at all. Steps into service, yeah. Jeez, thank you. I forgot it all the way from there to here. That's a really good thing, and I learned last night. I thought I was going to do an hour on it, so I had to unedit. I mean, I had to uncut it this morning, and because I'm going to do 30 minutes, and then we're going to get into participation hooting at it. So I'm going to have to get at it real, real hot and heavy. I like that that introduction to the to what we're going to do here is steps into service. But a lot of times we treat service like it's a separate entity, like it's a separate kind of activity, instead of being the outcome of what the steps are about. And so that's essentially what I want to get at. If I'm going to talk 4 hours, I don't need to prepare. If I've got 30 minutes, I got to prepare. And so I jotted down a little bit of keep it short and simple, stupid stuff here. Just one thing, just to kind of set a tone, maybe. If you look in the book, if there was another word for alcoholism, it would be self-centered, fear-based self-centeredness and isolation. And I say that because service comes right full swoop into why it's so important in our own recoveries. And so I want to kind of approach it that way. And I like that notion of steps. I want to put it in the context as a step. Now, obviously, we won't have time to go through them, but let me just distill it right down to the essence of what the steps are according to Tom I. That little thing in the 12 and 12 that says our steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, that if practice is a way of life, will expel the obsession and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That's why I like to look at the steps, you know, that they're a way of life. They're not a series of obstacles to climb. They're a way of life that if we practice, amazing things happen. And I like to look at them, if they do break down into sort of working units, the way I would look at it is that the first three are basically the foundation for recovery. Not really recovery. They're the steps that stop the bleeding, stop the drinking. They're the steps that give us that base in surrender that's so critical to recovery. And then the hope in the second step, and then the use of the power in the third step. And so what that does for me is that it really constitutes the foundation for recovery. It's not about restoration. That's about hanging on and surviving. I know people who have gone that far in the program and not another step and have died sober. You know, the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you quit when you reach the point that you're willing to settle for. And so if you're willing to settle for survival on a daily basis, that's quite adequate. And you can live with some peace. Not enough for an aggravated case like me. The next group that I like to look at, I'm going to break them down a little bit more than I normally would, it's understanding the illness. In that inventory process, it's not just about finding about naughty behavior. It's about starting to understand, one, that I am truly beat, that I truly have an illness called alcoholism. It's not a run of bad drinking or a run of bad luck. There is something constitutionally different about me and other people who are not alcoholic. If I take a drink, I cannot predict what I'll do. I have an illness called alcoholism. It's permanent. It ain't going nowhere. And the inventory process is the thing that anchored that fact for me. It also opened the door to understanding that there's a whole lot more to not drinking than not drinking. A whole lot more. There's a whole lot more to alcoholism than drinking. And so what it does is starts to open the door to what defects of character are about. Heard somebody say one time, and I agree with it, that we alcoholics are not a unique breed. We're just like other people, only more so. And we don't have... you know, think about it. And that's true. You know, every human being experiences fear. Every human being experiences isolation and anger and disgust and guilt and shame. We're not unique. But when we have those things, they go beyond just as kind of a nuisance level and often become disabilities, real disabilities. And so the difference with us is that we'll tend to go more extreme for whatever reason. And we could do a causation seminar if we wanted to, but the fact of the business is, when I look at my alcoholism, I've got to understand, what is it that drives this ship? What is it that makes a drink so important to me? What is it that makes it do something for me more special than does the average cat? And so, 4 and 5 basically help me understand that illness. What is it that I'm dealing with here? What is it that's gotten me into bondage of self? And then 6 and 7 are about change. Critical point in the program where I think you either get into real recovery or you detour into survival. 6 and 7, I think, are a pivotal point. Where we've taken a look at the illness, we've taken a look at the nature of this thing, and now we've reached a point where you want to get well or don't you? You want to be free or don't you? Are you willing to change or aren't you? You want to work on one side of the street or are you going to try to straddle the middle? And so it's a real critical decision point for me. And then 8 and 9, it's the healing steps in a way. They're the healing steps in that they're the place where we go back and straighten out the wreckage of the past. Where we start to fix our jangled and distorted relationships with the world around us, whether it's people, places, or things, but where we start to get peace and reconciliation with the folk that are and things that are important in our lives. And so critically important steps there. That, I think, they're the freedom steps. They're the steps that make us free. My belief is that I will never be a free man. I don't care if I stay sober 80 years. I will never be a free man until I go back and make right the wrongs that are my history. Because every time I abused or misused any kind of person, place, or thing, I didn't win a battle. I lost a battle and paid for it with a piece of my soul. And those things don't go away. They don't go away. Time does not heal. Those kinds of things are buried deeply in here, and I will never be at peace. I'll never be free until I go back and make right those things. And that's what those steps are about. They're the ones that fix it so I can take my place in the world comfortably, engage in life like any other human, and do fairly well. Can do doggone well. And so hugely important steps in 8 and 9. Now, I kind of rushed through that a little bit because those are the steps that prepare us for service. Those are the things that get us ready to be able to go out and not be hangdog and apologetic and all that kind of stuff, where we can go out and be free and not have that guilt kind of thing that we drag around. And so we're ready to go into service. And kind of interesting to me that... much more than interesting, it's critically important to me that when we I got him here. I'll figure out something. It's too tilted. I'm going to have it in my lap if I try to use that thing. I think it's something awfully important. Well, there's all these things are a transition, but when we finish 8 and 9, I think there's a profoundly important transition that occurs. And if you think about it, y'all probably could, most of you could recite it. I can't, but at the end of it, we go through the promises. Yeah, and those unbelievable things that are promised to happen before we're even halfway through the first nine steps. And these things will have happened. And then, at the end of nine, the ball game changes. The ball game changes. Will, last night, asked me a question. He said, "Do you still do the step with your sponsor?" I said, "No, I don't do the step with my sponsor. When my sponsor and I talk about step, we talk about steps in terms of how we're using them, how we use them as a tool. How do we, you know, I'm not in the business of fix me at my point in sobriety. Doesn't mean I'm healed. But if I'm still walking around checking my pulse every 30 minutes, I better take a look at what I'm doing. Because you go back to what I said about what's in the 12 and 12. Our steps are a set of principles, or whatever they call it, group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, not done once a year, but if practiced as a way of life, will free me from the obsession to drink and give me a life that will make me happily and usefully whole. Now, you think about that, some, that sounds a little sacrilegious. That mean that you get to the point you don't need to work steps? No. You need to work steps every day, but it becomes a way of life. It's not a mechanical thing. You know, I don't get up in the morning and say, "I think I'll do step 10. You know, I don't do that. I don't go to bed at night and say, "I think I'll do step 11. You know, those principles that I operate by become a normal way to live. And they're the things that lead me into service. I want to just kind of draw us in a little bit on. I'm going to draw in on somebody else's book. Mine has shrunk a little here. Yeah, I'm glad that you're old, Paul. That. In step 10, you know, that it's written as if it's about, you know, keep your finger on your pulse, you know, how you're doing. What's hidden in that little step is amazing, you know, because the inventory part of it is the tip of the iceberg for my money. You know, this business about where am I wrong and how do I fix it, it's the tip of the iceberg. And the real message of step 10, let me just refer to a couple things in here that are real keys to me. One thing here about when these crop, you know, we keep watching for those character defects. We keep watching for those things to get out of whack, like resentment or fear or, you know, anger, stuff like that. We keep watching for those because while they are removed, they ain't removed very far. They're about one day of not practicing the principles removed. And you let me go about a day without practicing the principles, those suckers will be knocking on my door big time. You know, what I believe is that the program of recovery lasts as long as I use it and not one more second. There ain't no cruise control. As long as I practice it, it works and beautifully. But the minute I quit, I don't go into neutral, I go into reverse, and I'll start slowly drifting backward. And so, we watch for those things. But listen to what it says about how we deal with it. Number one, we ask God to remove it. Second, we discuss it with somebody. You know, if it deserves discussion, we discuss it with somebody. And third, we take actions to deal with it. We don't go into Freudian analysis. We don't need to write a book about it. We don't need to go up on the mountain and stare at our navels or go into a whole bunch of anguish. You know, we goof, that's all. We goof. And then we immediately take care of business and deal with that sucker. You don't let it, and that's the utility of that inventory and action thing, that we don't make a career out of fixing one little goof. And if it gets serious, then we'll do something else. But most of the time, if we're on top of our game, we're gonna recognize it quick, we're gonna act on it quick. And that's the intent. And then, hear what it says. We take that action, then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. We don't dwell on the fixing of that thing, we get on with the business of living. because when we move into 10, 11, and 12, what we're moving into is how to put these principles to work as a way of life in everything that we do. And when we do it that way, you can't avoid service. It's just a natural product of the process. Service is built in if I do these principles. Yeah. And so right above that, there's a line that to me is pretty important. One, we've entered the world of the spirit. You know, we're living a spiritual kind of a life. And somewhere in the book says that it's a spiritual life, either everything or it's nothing. You know, we're practicing everything that we do. So we've entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Not insight or clarity, but understanding and effectiveness. You know, how well do I understand the illness? How well do I understand the dilemma of somebody in a treatment center? How well do I understand the dilemma of somebody walking in? How well do I understand how to deal with somebody who doesn't know what their problem is? Understanding and effectiveness. Is what I do worthwhile in terms of working? Now, it's time to take a look at not just blundering through, but thoughtfully looking at how to engage in stuff, how to improve in understanding and effectiveness. It's also a point where, yeah, I think, I'll just mention it and maybe come back with it, but I don't know if I will or not, but I'll just mention it. It's a point where I have to start to understand that if I really want to be of service, I've got to get out of my own shadow. I've got to be able to recognize that service is a lot more than just doing what's immediately in front of me. Like Paul was talking about going down to the kitchen. You know, that's a service. That's a service thing. He says, all right, have a cookie with you. You've got to take care of yourself, but keep one free to do something with. Yeah. And starting to recognize that service is a kind of a unifying activity. When I think about service, I have to think about my group. My group is part of my kit of spiritual tools. If I go work with an alcoholic one-on-one, I can do that. My God, anybody that says they can't do that, it never has read working with others. That's the most detailed manual I have ever read about how to do something. If you think you know how to do 12-step work, read working with others. I guarantee you, you know how to do it. Beats the devil out of how to put a wagon together. I say about that this morning that they've got full ideas of how to put a wagon together, and I swear to God, they ought to publish an encyclopedia on it. It's complicated. That, this is simple. We've got, this is real simple compared to that. So, how to work with others. If I work with an alcoholic, and I get him convinced that this program's worth trying, like an old boy working on John, he was a hard case, I tell you. Old cowboy didn't give up though, did he? He wrestled you to the ground. If that's good to do, but that cowboy didn't heal him, he took him to AA. Yeah. And so what I have to recognize is that my group is a huge part of my effectiveness. And if I don't have a good group where I can confidently take an alcoholic and know that he's going to get the message, I got a limited toolkit. And so I have to recognize that. It don't matter how good I am at doing this thing, if I don't have a group that delivers, what I'm doing is conning the guy. I'm conning him, and it won't hold up. So I have to recognize that. I have to recognize that the forces of Alcoholics Anonymous around me are a part of what I'm part of. And so if I really want to be effective, then I got to look at things that will get me beyond just my own narrow view and into a broader view of what this is about. And so learning how to be effective is a part of the deal. And that whole business, and I'm not going to itemize all this stuff, but that whole business in 10, 11, and 12 are about how to put these principles to work everywhere. And it really is not all that hard. You know, when I first got in the program and heard folk talking about living a spiritual life and all that, sounded to me like they were heavenly zombies or something, you know, that they just kind of pray and God put them on automatic and let them just sort of cruise through life. And it sounded that mystical to me. A spiritual life sounded like some kind of a magic show, you know, that if you just sort of pay your dues, one day you get zapped sober. That's what it sounded like. I never thought it was going to happen, and I was kind of scared it would. And as I wasn't all that keen about getting turned into a heavenly robot, I had some resistance to it. And what these steps do is bring that down to earth. And by the time I get to this point, I'm ready to start practicing the spiritual thing. Now, the book lays out a lot of ways to engage this, the spiritual thing in 10, 11. Let me just tell you what I do. And I try to do that. I did it now this morning because I didn't have my right equipment to do it, so I just did it. Do it anywhere. I do it on airplanes, walking the dog. I do it all kinds of places. But I've got a favorite place, and most of y'all, this is not a strange crowd to me, most of y'all, some of you don't know that I got a pond, and there's a story behind it that I won't tell right now, but I got a pond out behind my house. It's a little pond, but it's a beautiful thing, and it's got a waterfall, and I'm a sucker for water. God knows, I love that, love waterfalls, love that kind of moving stuff. It just like that river up by Bear Tooth. That's one of the most wonderful places. I sat out on a rock and that river did it in Montana, praying I wouldn't fall into that river. Okay, freeze slammed to death up there, that stuff. You do it anywhere. But what I do is a matter of routine now. And this is how I get into service. I mean, I don't have to plan it and target stuff. What I do is get into the right condition, the way it's laid out here. And what I do every morning, I go out, that's just, you know, bad weather or something, but I go out and sit down by that pond. And I just kind of watch the fish or give them some groceries. Then I just kind of watch them bopping around doing their thing. Listen to that waterfall. And I just sort of feel myself settling down, yeah. You don't have to start humming or anything. I just sort of settle down and get clear, get into a good frame of mind. And then, in the process, I talk to my higher power and I say, what I ask God to do is three basic things. One is to make me mindful of the gift I've been given. And this is my view of the gift I've been given. You know, I have an illness that's shared by people all over this globe. All over this globe. I know of no society that's not touched by it. Millions and millions, probably billions of alcoholics. There are a few of us, and a few more, that add up to just about a tiny blip on the radar screen. When you look at the world population of alcoholics and those of us in AA, my God, we're barely a blip on the screen. Now, I don't ponder why us. I don't ponder why me. But I guarantee you, I don't take it for granted. 95% of alcoholics in this world die of the illness quite young, never knowing there's a way out. And I've been given a gift, man. I have been given a gift of a brand new way of life, of freedom, and real opportunities to engage in life. Not only not drinking, good God, that's just a bare beginning, but being restored and where I come from. So I want to be mindful of that. Yeah, I want to be mindful that I didn't just give up a social life and take on AA. No. I'm a guy who has been given a new life by the amazing grace of God. His business, why? Not mine. But God knows I don't want that to be a no-brainer. I want to be keenly aware, mindful of what I've been pulled from. And that keeps me ever grateful and ever mindful of how I fit into this picture. And then if I feel that, I want to act like it. I want to act like that. I want to be a good example of the gift I've been given. That ain't asking much, is it? Yeah. Yeah, I want to be somebody who, when I go around and interact with people, if people don't know I'm an AA, it ain't my fault. I guarantee you, I don't hide it much. If you don't want to know and don't want to know a lot about it, don't ask me, because I guarantee I'll pin you to the wall. So I'm not a shrinking violet with that. But if I'm going to do that, there is a huge responsibility that goes with that, because I want to be a good example. I don't want to be somebody who repels people from Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to be somebody who talks about a spiritual life and my mouth sounds like an open sewer. I don't want to do that, because that's not a message that I want to communicate, because I don't think it's a message at all. I think it's a warning sign. And so I don't want to do that. I want to be mindful of what I've been given, and at a minimum, I want to be a good example that the gift wasn't wasted. And not a whole lot, is it? But see, that's what I want to do, and that's what I'm doing in the morning, is getting prepared to go out with that frame of mind. And then the third thing I ask for is for to be sensitive to opportunities to be of service. If you say that prayer, you better mean it. I guarantee you better mean it, because you'll be amazed before you get out the door. Opportunities to be of service are everywhere. Everywhere. I rarely see anybody that doesn't need some service of some kind. Now, that doesn't just mean being a GSR or a delegate or a trustee. Those are noble areas of service. But it means just being a decent human. It means just being somebody who lightens somebody's load. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. You know, just to be of service so that I'm thinking of others and not dwelling on me. And my God, how that works. And what it does is it absolutely changes the character of the world I live in. That's a fact. That's a fact. I travel all the time, and most of the time I'm meeting strangers all the time. But the overwhelming majority of people that I meet are warm, gracious, considerate people. Nearly always. You know, I'm amazed at sometimes, you know, like in airports, you know, where everybody's mad and everybody's in a hurry. Yeah, and just taking an extra 5 seconds to just sort of kid around a little bit with the person waiting on me. Amazing what happens. Amazing what happens. Just simple stuff. Yeah. And so that's what I want to be. You know, I want to be somebody who is service minded. Like the book said, that we need to focus on others. You know, I would submit to you that you don't deal with a problem whose core is self-centeredness by focusing on yourself. I think they call that feeding the illness, you know. So there's great therapy in what I'm talking about. This is not becoming Mahatma Gandhi. This is about just becoming a good functioning human being. And the old cliche that you hear is more than a cliche. You cannot give away more than you get. And that's a fact. That is a fact. And I've got 1,000 stories about that, but I'll just pick one. Just recently, a buddy and I that rides a Moto Guzzi motorcycle, and he won't steal my gold wing. We were talking motorcycle. And I was just up in Oregon, and I had to go from Oregon to Vancouver, and so I drug my wife along. We rented a car in Oregon. So I'm renting a car. Now, you know how it is in a car rental. You know, everybody's trying to get first in line, and you got 50 people trying to go through one keyhole, and so you know, a whole lot of push and shove, and the poor folk up there trying to wrestle around and show you maps and tell you where the tourist attractions are, and they want to tell you, get out of here and drive the car. And so they're not really happy people. So I got up there, and this lady started telling me something, and I just started messing with her. I mean, I just called it, I don't like a tense, unfriendly environment. And so I just started messing with her a little bit. And I had ordered a mid-size little ugly car, because I could afford that. And so when we started to do the deal, she said, would you be willing to take something fancy? It's their second highest priced car, Yukon or some such thing. Anyway, big old things. She said, would you be able to? I said, what for? And she said, well, I don't know. I just kind of like for you to try this car. And I said, oh, my God. People always want me to do stuff, you know. She said, well, I'd appreciate it if you would. I said, okay, I'll take the thing. Well, I knew she was giving me a luxury car. I didn't ask for anything. I didn't want that. You know, all I'm doing is trying to give off some warm signals to a human being. See what I mean? And so that whole experience, instead of getting through a hassle and say, boy, I'm glad I got through there, I've got a warm memory. And it's just that way. I mean, the world works that way. So when we say that this, it's true that Alcoholics Anonymous is a selfish program, but it's the weirdest kind of selfish you have ever seen. It's about 90% give and about 10% get. And when I give, stuff happens. And so I guess what I'm saying is that service is not an outside issue. Service is not an extra added attraction. My firm belief is this. Any recovery that does not have an active service component in it is a recovery that has been shortchanged. I believe that. Any group that does not have an active service life beyond the walls of the meeting is a group that has been shortchanged. And so my belief about service is that it is integral to this whole process. And if I do these steps as a way of life, I don't have to search it out. It'll become an instinct, and it'll happen everywhere I go. Thanks. I look forward to the participation. Yeah, thank you.
It says here we're going to have a 30-minute break, and then we'll participation. It's not on here. Okay, we're going to have... I heard you the whole time, and I was sitting here looking. Where's participation? And I couldn't see it. All right, I've been shown the way. We're going to have participation. Is John L. from Norman here? Mr. Moto Guzzi.
My name is John Lloyd, and I am an alcoholic. And I've been sober since December 18, 2000. My home group's a Phoenix group, and I have a Moto Guzzi. Now, Tom's delightful. That was a good talk, Tom. It's really has made me think. But I got to tell you, I'm a little worried. Last year at this conference, we had a financial seminar thing, and as the years progressed, I thought I was making progress, and I have $10 in my bank account, and I almost didn't come to the conference. So I don't know what this holds for next year. You know, I may be the most selfish SOB around and not quit all the service jobs and everything. Who knows? I was trying to make a joke, but that didn't come out too good, did it? just beware what you hear here. I probably should shut up. I enjoy these conferences. I enjoy our speakers. John was great last night, and I've enjoyed the fellowship, and I look forward to coming, and I lie a lot, and... every year I threaten to not come back, and I keep coming back. I really appreciate what you shared. I really, really do. It's because I get to wondering sometimes, you know, well, I've kind of gone through this mechanical step procedure, and now what? More jobs, you know, yuck. But the more I do that, the better I the more comfortable and useful I find myself becoming. And for me, it is a chore. I am not naturally giving. I like to think that I am. I like to think that I'm outgoing and helpful to people, but it really takes effort for me because I really am selfish. And that is my core problem. So alcohol being but a symptom. So thank you. I'm done.
Tom from Bristol. Well, I came here last year, and I'm Tom. I'm alcoholic. Excuse me. But I didn't want to be here, and I had to get drug up here, and I was 3 months sober, and I just would have rather done anything but come here, and I went back out and got drunk, and had to spend a little more time in that misery. And today I came and I'm 8 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days sober, and I really wanted to come. And I'm really enjoying being here, and I guess that's all. Thank you.
Brian W. from Sepulpa. Not here. Oh, there he is. Come on up.
Come on down.
Thank you. I'm Brian and I'm an alcoholic. This is my first time here. I'm going to blame my sponsor for that. But anyway, if anybody needs some work on their spiritual tools, that'd be me. So I'm just going to listen to what you guys have to say, and I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, Bob.
Louie P. from Norman.
My name's Louie. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since March 31st, 2002. And I heard it said up here, several times that people didn't want to be here. And I kind of fell in that category. I kind of had it's been a kind of a trying week for me, but these tools that I got to use, like it says up there, I'm willing to believe that they work. And if I just keep doing what I'm doing and what's in front of me, trying to do the right things, things just always seem to work out. And just last night, right after I got here, started fellowshipping, and things just started getting better. And and that's why I come to these things and keep going to my meetings and just try to stay committed. And I'm glad everybody's here. I was going around looking, reading all the names up here on these banners last night, and miss some of these people that ain't here. Just thinking about memories. Some of them ain't even on this earth anymore, and some of them went on their own way. And some have moved on, moved out of state or whatever. But there's a lot of guys on these banners that are here, and I'm grateful for that.
Thank you, Dave.
Keith K. from Tulsa.
All right, man. My name's Keith. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm excited to be here. I can get up here and not have to worry about what my hair looks like. And it's just a bunch of guys, hanging out. And I'm here to make friends, been calling a lot of people here lately and making a lot of friends and actually starting to laugh, And so I'm looking forward to the fellowship and stuff you shared, touched my heart, and I'm just grateful to be here. Glad you guys are here. Thanks.
Juan D. from Norman.
Juan!
My name is Juan Diaz. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since October 31st, 2004.
I'm just going to grab this.
I don't know. I like being here. I like going to conferences, especially men conferences. It's pretty cool. It sure beats where I used to be. You know? I mean, that's just... I like being here rather than being in an abandoned house selling drugs or drinking a lot. You know, it's just... so grateful for the life I have. Being sober is just, it's really good. I mean, my life is really good. I got a lot of gratitude. I got up and prayed this morning, feeling that wind and sun was coming up. It's just, I like being out here. Last year wasn't so great, but now it's really good. And I just hope it just continues tomorrow. Just try to be a good example today. I really like what you had to say, Tom. You straight, clear cut, and to the point, and just—I mean, you couldn't miss the message you were trying to talk about, what you were saying. But I just appreciate everybody being here. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve C. from Shawnee.
Good morning. I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic. Morning, everybody. My sobriety is February 5th of 85. I'm sure glad to be here this morning. Thank Tom for sharing this morning. Appreciate that. And sure enjoyed hearing John tell his story last night. Had a good week. Listening to Tom this morning, I keep thinking about the reason that I do things today. And I know the reason I did them steps the first time, because every time them guys that were hanging around the group, like those guys John talked about last night, would just keep telling you, no, you don't have to. You can go get drunk and die. You don't have to do that inventory. You don't have to make them amends. I mean, every time it seemed like you come up to another step. Oh, no, Steve, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do that at all. Go get drunk, you know. And there was one in our group, too, that was, here's a dollar. We'll buy you first drink. Get on out of here. And he's still sober, named Wayne. A lot of them guys know him. But the reason that I do those steps in the service has changed from that, and I still do it because I want to stay sober, don't get me wrong, but from that, from what it's going to do for me, it's changed to because of what it's done for me, because of what's already been done. How could I say no to these requests? How could I treat people poorly? How can I? And I still do it. I still fall way short a lot of times. But because of what's been done through these steps, because of what God has done, because that obsession has been removed, because for the most part my life is happily and usefully whole, because of the things that has been done, then service just seems to naturally follow. How could I not be concerned about my home group and get there early and, you know, stay late and help set up or clean up or whatever needs to be done? Those things seem to just follow natural out of the gratitude for what has happened. And they don't, what seemed at first to be a burden is the thing I look forward to the most. I don't know about y'all, but I was not just naturally unselfish and giving and kind. I still got a long way to go. When you start mentioning those things, you think, oh man, what if somebody saw me last week? But whenever, one of the first things that my sponsor had me do was there'd be a new guy show up at the group and they'd say, Steve, go talk to him. And I think, I don't want to go talk to him, look at him. You know, I mean, he needs help. I don't want to help him. And now, you know, and they just made me. They just dragged me over there and put me in front of him and say, this is Steve, you know, and then they make me talk to him. And then after a while you start doing it because, you know, they just look at you. They don't have to tell you or twist your arm and take you over there. They just kind of look across the room at you like, you know, and you go ahead and do it, and then pretty soon you just do it, pretty soon you notice somebody you hadn't seen before, and you stick your hand out, and you say, "Hey, my name's Steve. Welcome. Come on, I'll show you where the coffee pot is. You can sit by me during a meeting." And then you start realizing that's the thing that you just look forward to. And I don't know how that happened, from doing something that I didn't want to do, that I was just forced to do, basically, to being the thing that I look forward to more than anything else, seeing a new guy walk in and thinking, "God dang, you know, tonight after meeting, we're going to sit down, and boy, we're going to let him have it." And you think, yeah, and you see somebody start nodding their head once in a while, and you think, man, you know, and how does that happen? That as a result of working these steps. So I don't think it mattered that I did them the first time just to save my own butt. Obviously it didn't. I had no unselfish reason for working them the very first time. I don't think there was a bit of it. But as a result of that, getting to live a life of service that I found to be the easiest way of life at all. I never dreamed that the things I would get to do today, that first of all I'd want to do them, and second of all that they would bring so much into my life, and that it would be easy. I looked at what them guys ahead of me did as just hard labor. Like, boy, just almost torture. You know, I'm doomed. I'm sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of my born days. I've got to hang out with these losers, you know. And then to come from that to full circle to realize, man, this is the best way of life I've ever known. Why did I fight it so much? I don't know. That's part of what's wrong with us, I think, is that we just don't want to do what's good for us. I don't know why. But to come full circle to being able to live the kind of life that I never dreamed was available to me, and it turns out to be the best way of life I've ever known. And, man, I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for those guys that were on me, that kept prodding me along, to keep doing things I didn't want to do. Because they cared enough about me to just ease me on up the trail, and hopefully because of that I get to stick around and do the same thing for somebody behind me. So thanks for having me this weekend. Sure enjoy it.
Will B. from Tulsa.
My name is Will Bryant, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since February the 6th of 1997, and really looking forward to coming here this weekend. My eighth weekend here at Rock Creek, and I was thinking about what Steve was saying and looking at the stages some of the guys the sponsor are at. You know, go talk to this guy. Go talk. What? Me? Get over there and talk to him. And now you look over at, you know, like Dave. Look at Dave, and he's like, "What? No, I don't want some cake. I'm fine." You know, it's, "No, I'm not talking about cake, buddy. Get over there and talk to the new guy, you know, come on." So it's a, and that was, you know, I mean, a couple of years ago, and so Dave's probably progressed, I'm sure. But I'm thinking, looking at these guys and really getting enjoyment out of talking to guys like Tom and different guys that I don't get to hang out with very much, even at my own home group, about working this stuff in our lives, you know, and really doing this stuff, and talking about the amends that are not fun to make and the ones that have to be made, and the rules and requirements that are programmed. Tells us that we have to do, and some of the things I don't want to do, but just that joy that you're talking about that I have received, you know, and a sincere life of gratitude and hopefully a life of service, you know, by my actions, like what you were talking about, you know, those things. I mean, there wasn't a prayer, there wasn't a line in the book, there wasn't a guy I could talk to on February the 5th this year when I found out my father had been murdered the day before. There was only actions I could take because I went to that space of desperation and despair and of hatred and you know, in my mind that I could not escape. And you guys came over to my house and you said, "Let's do this. Let's talk to some people. Let's go." And then so my sobriety date being February the 6th, that's when I chaired my home group meetings to celebrate my birthday. And I had a commitment to chair my group 2 days later, and that's what I did. in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't want to be here. I don't care about this anymore, and this is worthless, and what's it all for? And the fact is, you know, by looking at my sponsor, he chaired this conference one year, actually the year I got married. So it's one reason I missed this conference one year. So I'm still making amends, a living amends for that, he says. And that'll be a continual process, I'm to believe. But he held his commitment. And just from a simple example like that, it hurt at the time because he was going to be at my wedding. I didn't get what I wanted, so I thought. But he chaired this conference and held his commitment. So what an example to me that on my home group that week, I got to chair the meeting at my group. And I didn't get to fall apart mentally or emotionally like I would have other than my own means. You know, I got to be there and I got to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to live through some devastating stuff that, you know, that you guys show me how to do. So, man, what a great week. And I love seeing guys come back here and just really kick into this deal and really dive into what we're doing here. And I'm thinking to myself, when Tom's talking, man, my mouth is sometimes like a... it's not good. It's not a good place, you know, not a good thing. And I got to really inventory myself and what I do and what kind of person I am and wherever I go, what kind of Alcoholics Anonymous member am I being. So I'm grateful to see these examples and the guys like put on this weekend. Glad for you guys that have been doing it for years and guys like Calvin, you know, and I thank you for letting me be a part of it. Thanks.
Bob T. from Norman.
Bob has left the building. I'm Bob and I am an alcoholic. I've been sober since May 29, 1998. I'm really grateful. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. I didn't even recognize the theme of the conference, but before we even got started early yesterday, started talking about the idea that the kit of spiritual tools, they're laid at our feet. That means I have to kneel down and get them. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't been doing that. Therefore, I get to enjoy the consequences. I'd say suffer the consequences, but it's a mess. If we don't, I know the tools work. I've been here long enough to have some periods of time where what you guys keep talking about, when you employ them, they work. But it's like, I can't build a house if I don't get a saw out, you know? So therefore, I'm really grateful to have made it this year. It's been difficult because I haven't been doing that. In fact, if I go on my coffee table at home and pick up my daily reflections, I believe my bookmark will be somewhere in July. And that makes it very difficult to maintain any sense of purpose. So I'm really grateful that you guys allow me to be of service here at this conference to try to get out of that and get back into the frame of mind and into the book. And there's some areas of that book that I have not touched in the action part. I mean, I've read them, I've discussed them, but I haven't taken the action. I really want to stay sober and stay with hanging out with you guys, but I really don't want to be here. You know what I mean? It's like I don't want to. I'm a guy who's been on a regular basis over the years, probably 5 to 6 meetings a week. It's just the way my schedule works out. I work at night, so I get up in the noon and start my day with a meeting. And that's been working very well. Until I decided I got some, you know, whatever, tired, bored, or so focused on the problem that I didn't want to go to any more meetings. I started picking meetings, which ones am I going to cut out. That's a part of the tools that you've given me that I've chosen not to use. So rather than try to paint a glowing picture about what could possibly happen to your life if you use these tools, I hope that I can paint the ugliest picture of what happens if you don't. Because sobriety, I mean, the insanity of not drinking is one thing. Inebriation without getting drunk is an experience that I do not want to revisit. But I also don't want to stay where I'm at right now and being sober and dark. That's all I have to offer. Thanks.
Lee G. from Shawnee.
My name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic. It's by the date of September 21st, 92. And I like what Bob was saying. It was what I was thinking about, the theme of the conference. If I know those tools are there, and if I use them, then I get the results, you know. And why don't I use them? And I do use them to some extent, you know, but every time I go through a situation during the day where I could be a good example about Alcoholics Anonymous, I could, my sponsor, I was going through some difficult situations early in sobriety, and he said, "You will go through this with grace and dignity." And I said, "Will I? I will? How do I do that? I've never done it before. I don't know how. I've always made like a complete ass of myself because I insisted, you know, no, you will do it my way or whatever, you know." And he said, "You take actions directly against your own self-will." And when I do service work, I'm still, at this point in my sobriety, you know, there's a line in the book and it said, that we'll be helping, I can't say it exactly, but it says we'll be helping people, but that feeling will be transcended, it'll be transcended by the feeling we get, you know. I don't know if you guys know what line I'm talking about, but that line has always intrigued me, and I can look it up, and I'm thinking, I'm waiting for that to happen to me, because I do service work, but I don't jump up for joy, you know, when I do it. When they say, you know, go do this, like, go talk to that guy, you know, I'm not going like, oh boy, I get to help another alcoholic, you know. I'm not joyful about it. I do it, but I'm not like joyful about it. I'm thinking, gee, you know, this guy might want some recovery and I might have to spend some time with him and schedule, you know, I might have to work with him. And I might, well, that, you know, that would take away the precious time that I want, that I have during my day to do what I want to do. You know, and I'm still, you know, selfish and self-centered. But I do those things anyway, you know, I'm on the committee at my group, and I belong to the Shawnee Big Book group, and I've been to a lot of Rock Creek conferences, and I appreciate guys like Warren. This is important to them. And Warren's not the only one, but I can remember at Michael. Guys like, this conference is important to them, and they take the time. They take a lot of time, and they put this thing on so that I can just drive over from Shawnee, and it's a real short drive, and it seems like, you know, every year they're going, come on, Lee, you know, Rock Creek Conference. There's no excuse not to be here for me. I don't have to drive a long way. And I always enjoy it. We always have just outstanding speakers, as we do Tom and John. But getting back to that, I guess I'm talking about that fourth dimension that they talk about. And that, as Tom was saying, that's still kind of a mystery to me. But it's a place where I want to get to. And I'm coming up, if I stay sober, you know, I celebrate. I always love this time of the year. I like this this conference. To me, it signifies that change of seasons. You know, summertime's over and the fall. And I love the fall time of the year. Football season and really things that I can really get selfish and self-centered about. But that fourth dimension, you know, that's always intrigued me. And it's I always want to go. That's where I want to be. That's where I want to go. But it's really difficult for a selfish, self-centered drunk like me. So if I pick up those, if I just use those tools, you know, use them, just use them. You know, save me from being angry. That's just use them and go on and go through this with grace and dignity. I'm just really grateful to be here. And I'm grateful to be sober today. Thank you. Thanks, Paul.
Okay. Now we will have a 30-minute break and be back here at 10:30. We recycle them because we like to spend money on food and not name tags here. So, please make sure that the cabins that y'all were staying in today or this weekend are clean. And I don't know for sure, but if there's still any more disposable cameras out, they need to be given to Bob or put back with the archives after the meeting. John's been recording everything all weekend, and he's got it for sale. Tapes are $4 for a single, $25 for a set. CDs are $7 for singles, and $30 for the set. Are there any more T-shirts? T-shirts are gone?
No.
T-shirts are gone.
Say Mike
20. Oh! There's one for sale, and Mike has it for $20. I think that's all the announcements, and I'm going to turn the meeting over to Tom now.
Good morning, guys. Good to see you. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And I got kind of steered in here February 2nd of 57, and by the grace of God, been here since, and been deeply, deeply grateful for that. And it's good to see you. I guess this paperwork is... And the wind don't mix. From the looks of the heavens, I knew it was too good to be true. yeah, that's right. Well, that's going to all lengths to make a guy feel at home. But this is the Rock Creek that I know and love. With. It is great to see you this morning, and I've enjoyed it. At the risk of using non-conference approved material, there was a guy named Henry Miller that's a writer. He wrote kind of raunchy little books. But he said something that's been on my mind this weekend for some reason. That just a little old snippet of a thing introducing a section of the book said, If you would find the riches of the Indies, or the treasures of the Indies, you must take the treasures of the Indies with you. And I thought about that when I was listening to the various kinds of feelings about coming to Rock Creek. And people who come to Rock Creek expecting something to happen that's going to drastically change their lives, probably going to get a little disappointed. Unless you came with that treasure in your heart, you have a hard time nurturing it here. And that just came to mind about old Henry and his messages. So I really wish you well in where we go from here. And if it didn't happen here, the next stop you make, take the treasure with you. Take the treasure with you. Go in there with a person who's got a vision of what life will be, and you'll find it there. But if you wait for somebody else to show it to you, probably going to be a futile trip. So, good luck. Good luck. And what I want to do this morning is just kind of visit around a little bit on, following up on some of the stuff we were talking about yesterday, I guess it was. And maybe tone that down a little bit into kind of real life stuff about where we are. I forgot exactly how I want to go at it. When you think about the spiritual life, the book says it awfully well that the spiritual life is not a theory, you have to live it. And it's either everything or it's nothing. And it's in the practice of stuff that the miracle happens. You know, that is not some kind of an all-encompassing thing that just sort of puts us into a new dimension and we just stay there. That the product of the spiritual life, what I found, is like I said the other day, that
the things that come to me in Alcoholics Anonymous are totally dependent on how current I am in my actions. And the minute I quit doing it, that's the minute that they stop happening. And so the spiritual life is a very, very real approach to living. And sometimes when we talk about that, I know when I first heard people talk about the spiritual life, it really did sound so far away from where I was that it was unattainable and almost unthinkable. And yet when you get right down to it, a very simple, very practical way to live. And so I want to pick up a little bit on what I was talking about the other day and bring that down to real life. You know, I mentioned about how I start my day. And that's how I start my day. But it doesn't mean that my day is going to be in the spiritual realm all day long. Because I live in a world where life goes on and there are challenges and there are sometimes very disappointing, sometimes frustrating things, sometimes things that are scary that I have to deal with. And so what I've found is that if I really want the spiritual life to be an effective tool in my life, I have to engage it to take care of the things that I encounter lots of days. And so what I do, like speaking to this group, that I never, even though I've done this 10,000, probably more than that, times, I never do it without an edge of anxiety. Somebody told me one time, if you ever lose that, keep your seat. Because your message has moved to your head instead of your heart. So if you're not a little uneasy with it, check out what you're doing. And so when I do that, I always take a minute and I talk to my higher power about what I want to do. And I don't ask God to tell me what to say. He gave me a brain to think that up. I don't ask for that. You know, what I ask for is to come in and be the best example I'm capable of being. To be somebody that can give a little inspiration and hope to somebody. To share honestly about who I am and about what this program means in my life. And to do what's right. You know, not to do what's popular or what somebody's going to really love or yuck it up about, but to do what's right. You know, I always remind myself that I don't think there's any such thing as an unimportant AA meeting. I don't think there's any such thing as a frivolous meeting. Now, we get a lot of frivolity, but underneath, every meeting is critically important. I guarantee you there's somebody sitting in this room today who's teetering in the balance. Teetering in the balance. And it's amazing how impactful things we do can be. And so I always kind of keep mindful of that. It doesn't keep me from having a good time. But it helps me to focus on what I'm doing so that I don't become a trained seal just throwing out a bunch of words, you know, that I actually try to communicate. And so when I do that, you know, I get prepared to do it. And it may not be the talk of the century, but it'll be as sound as any talks I'm capable of making. And so I do that. And that's just one example, you know, of the things that I do. When I have something to do that I'm fearful about, or angry about, you know, or just something that puts me on the edge a little bit, I almost never just walk in to take care of business. Almost never. I always take the time to do basically that kind of thing. And to before I go, I'll give you an example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. And they're hundreds of thousands of them, but I'll give you just a couple examples of what that looks like in real life. In the business world, you're going to have some things that go well and some things go bad. And I was running an organization that consisted, when I was a prison administrator, it consisted of three prisons. You know, I had a warden in each one of those places and a program there. And I was sitting in a meeting one day with some of the guys, and I got a phone call, and it was the guy that was over me. And he said, "Yeah, I'm glad I caught you, Tom. I'm coming down to see you." And I said, "What for?" And he said, "I'm going to fire one of my wardens." Yeah. And
I mean, that guy worked for me. He also counted on me to be his the guy that looked after him, not just bossed him, but he counted me to be the guy that's going to make sure he doesn't get screwed over. And so I held down the reaction that was right on the tip of my tongue, and I said, it might be a good idea if you meet with me first. And he understood what I said, and so we set up another meeting, which he thought it over and canceled. But now you talk about a hot camper. Man, I'm hot. Yeah, that's an ultimate insult to a manager. I'm going to come in and fire one of my key leaders. Ain't no way. Well, I was hot. Now, so I always try not to take my business home. But I ain't that good, because sometimes I do. And that day I went home, and you know how sometimes you just absolutely caught up in it, that you just don't trust yourself around people? So I went home, and I knew this was uncharacteristic, but I got home, and the wife and both kids were there, and I said, I'm going to take a little walk. Well, they sensed that there was something wrong. Well, I swear to God, it looked like a duck and the little ducklings going. They followed me around the place where I'm going to walk. You know, just make sure I didn't self-destruct or something. As we got back to the house, and I said, I'm going again, but y'all please stay here. You know? I felt like an idiot leading the parade out through there. But you know, I had to do something. And that was on a Friday. And the next day was Saturday. My boss lived about 80 miles away. I called him up and I said, are you going to be home in the morning? He said, yeah. I said, be all right if I come to see you? And he said, yeah. Well, if I was still on the street, I'd use a different term. I'll just say I was extremely hot. You know, but I'll stop at that. Extremely hot. And because, I mean, you know, I'm a guy who treasures his career. But there was no way that I would accept that. Now, suppose I had gone into that with that absolute mountain of anger that I had. Suppose I'd have walked in. So I'm going to this guy's house to challenge him on something on a Saturday when he's not even at work. And but I had to go. He had to blow a fuse, one or the other. And so I went, and he tried to tap dance for a long time, and he finally got tired of dancing and said, took a breath, and I said, let me tell you why I'm here. And so he knew why I was there, but I had to tell him anyway. And I said, I tell you this, you're not going to fire my guy unless you fire two of us, because I'm not, I go if he goes. And the old boy, I didn't know what he'd do, but he just kind of blanched a little, you know, and he kind of got a little ashen looking, and I won't say what he said either, but he basically said, Tom, I think I screwed up. I said, well, maybe you did. And so he withdrew that. But see, what I'd done before I got there was to get spiritually fit to engage in that, so that I didn't resort to just street-level junk about how to resolve a problem. But I went in there with principles intact. I went in there also with the full knowledge that I may be for sale, but not at that price. Not at that price. And so what I was able to do was to take a very difficult situation, and by using these tools, be able to do it in a calm and reasonable kind of way. Now, I won't say that I wasn't a little forceful, but I was a reasonable thinking person instead of somebody just going into a temper tantrum like I would have been if I'd have done it the next day. Now, that's just one example. Yeah. Now, when you talk about the spiritual life, it's not a matter of just getting gooey, soft, warm, and fuzzy. It's about being equipped to take our places in life. And what we get restored to is life. We don't get to transcend life, we get restored to life. Sometimes it is absolutely wonderful, sometimes it pure sucks. And most of the time, it's just life. It just sort of goes along at a kind of shade of gray. You know, we just sort of go through life, working, eating, taking care of business. And so, we don't transcend stuff. But what we do is become equipped to deal with stuff in a very effective way. My experience has been that with all of those kinds of situations that I've had to deal with, I've never lost one in terms of, you know, it not having a good outcome. Because when I do my praying to get set up for that, what I do is I pray for God to help me do what's right. Not win, not lose, but to do what's right. And if I'm trying to do what's right, I can't lose. Because if somebody's got a better idea, I need to be open enough to listen to it. But I've never failed to have a favorable outcome in anything I've done. And so when you say the spiritual life is not a thing, that's exactly what it means. And so I guess you could call that targeted use of the power. But it's realizing that I don't get into a state of bliss and everything just goes my way all the time. I'm going to run into stuff. But the power I have is sufficient if I will pray with the principles in mind so that I can take care of stuff. And so that applies in anything that I do. What it does is makes me a pretty doggone worthy adversary. Because I don't have any hidden agenda. You know, so when I go in, when I am in fit spiritual condition, I got nothing under the table. I'm laying it right out in the open. And when I'm like that, I can handle myself pretty well. And so, you know, we got a partner. A lot of folks may not know about him, but I got a boss that stays with me all the time. And he'll keep me from doing stupid stuff. And so sometimes, I guess my point is that this doesn't make me a goody two-shoes doormat. And what it does is gives me the spiritual tools to go out and engage in life and take my place responsibly and effectively in this world. And so I like that stuff about the spiritual life is not a theory. And the way the book says it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but keep those big feet on the ground. Because that's where we live, that's where we work, that's where we do our thing. And so in looking at how this spiritual life gets in and influences and affects how I do, it absolutely enhances everything that I do, bar none. The other thing I want to just kind of to merge in a little with that is the thing I was talking about, and a couple of us chatted about it later on. It's to say that, and I've met very few alcoholics who go through recovery that don't go through a period when they're kind of searching for balance. And balance, it's an interesting kind of thing. The translation for balance is how do I back off from something, is what that usually means. And so balance is a nice way of saying it. Now, balance is appropriate. It's appropriate. You know, a well-ordered day ought to be made up of about four equal parts of what? Sleep. We don't do that here. I was listening to the sounds of recovery. I lived right over there in that thing. I was listening to the sounds of recovery when that raucous whatever y'all were playing out there. It requires a lot of vocal activity, whatever you were playing. And so I was listening to the sounds of recovery about 1 o'clock this morning. And my God, for daylight, you're out here again, you know. So anyway, I got me off on that. I just wanted to say it, I guess. Putting this thing to work in our lives, sometimes we do feel a lot of uneasiness and discomfort about how it fits into our lives and what price do we pay. Sometimes, and I kind of build it around this idea that I said it myself for a number of years, and sometimes you'll hear people say AA has got to be the most important thing in your life. Don't believe that for one second. Don't believe that. AA does not have to be the most important thing in my life. My recovery has to be the most important thing in my life. AA is a means to that end. But when you say AA is the most important thing in your life, yeah, it's characterizing this thing in a way different than the spiritual life undergirding what you do. It flies in the face of that. Now, we say that just in innocent ignorance a lot of times. But if you think that through, you know, you think about what the reaction would be. You know, I'll give an example with it. That my son, you know, when he finally became self-supporting, God knows, took a long time. I told him he didn't owe me a thing. That the only thing he had to do was the first time he transplanted into anything. I don't care if it's a fingernail. I wanted a 500 SL convertible. Other than that, feel no obligation. I don't know. I'm not going to get my TED yet. But he was at our house one night, and he feeling his oats a little bit because he's had a little dough in his pocket. He said, "Dad, I'd like to take you guys to dinner." And I said, "Well, that's nice, yeah." And I don't know. I guess I don't know if he saw a flicker. I didn't say anything, but it was my home group night. And so I don't know if I reacted or something, or his mind kicked in. As soon as he said that, he said, "Oh, wait a minute, this is your group night." And I said, "Yeah, that's right." And he said, "Oh, shoot, we'll do it a different time, you know." Well, I mean, that was a no-brainer. But now you contrast that, and I hope I can make this point clearly, that what it underlines is the importance between differentiating commitments and activity. If you say AA's got to be the most important thing, that means you put a holy grail over everything that goes under the banner. And if you try to have relationships with people and you wave that banner at them every time they question what you're doing is abusing the privilege. And so when you do that, you make a value judgment. And it says that this is important and you're not. And I'll guarantee you, if I tried to do that in my house, I would have one mad Canadian who would be trying to make barbecue out of me. Because there ain't no way she'd buy that. Nor would I try to sell it. But see, the difference is that my son, the way he reacted that night, he understands my commitments. Now, I do a lot of stuff. I've got three fundamental commitments every week of my, well, four right now, but one of them will only last 4 months. But I've got three fundamental commitments that are not negotiable with anybody, unless it is an absolute critical need that I need to respond to. And that's my home group. Yeah, my home group meets twice a week. And that's not under the heading of nice to do. That's something I do. That's a commitment that anchors my life. That's the foundation of my recovery. And so what that does is it gives me my working space. And it anchors me solidly in a program. I never have to contemplate what I'm going to do. Because on those nights, it's automatic. It's just automatic. So that's a commitment, my home group. My prison commitment. I made a commitment, and that's as solid a commitment as my home group is. And the fourth one I've just added is just a temporary thing. We're taking a group of folk through the steps, and that's going to take 16 sessions. So that'll be a commitment for those 16 sessions. Now, those are commitments. They're not up for grabs. So people who know me, I make sure they understand that, then they can trust me. They can trust me because that tells you who I am. I've had people come to town and ask, Tom, and every stranger on the street will say, "Is this Monday?" They say, "Yeah." "Oh, well, he's over at the First Baptist Church." Because people know that. And they can trust me for doing what I say. In the real world, they call that integrity, that you do what you say you're going to do. Here, we call that a solid commitment, you know, that's steadying in my life. And it makes my family able to say, like my son did, "Oh, yeah, this is group night." See, that was not a value judgment. That was not saying hanging out with the guys is more important than hanging out with you. It's very important. If people understand what you're committed to, then they can trust you. But if it's always up for grabs and just running down somewhere just because somebody wants to chat with you a little bit, that's not under the same heading. You know, that's an activity that's negotiable and can be moved around. That's fundamental to that business of finding balance, you know, so that I differentiate my solid commitments from the things I do. My calendar, if I have stuff on my calendar, that becomes a commitment for a specific day. Like Rock Creek, thanks to Warren, Rock Creek's been on my calendar for about 8 years, I think. A long time. And when Rock Creek's down there, that's not up for grabs. That's a commitment when I write it down. Now, my folks have access to my calendar. It's not hidden. And so my family is invited to make commitments if they want to. And what does that mean in real life? I'll give you an example. I was on the phone with somebody that was getting ready to book something, and I don't think my wife was eavesdropping. She was just listening, and she was standing at the door, and she saw that calendar. She said, "What are you booking?" I showed her. She said, "My God, that's when we got our son's birthday planned." My language changed. I said, nope, sorry, I can't do that. Got a commitment. See, I was talking about balancing principles. You know, that's a principle of a family matter that was very important. And so we committed that. And so it was not competing with anything. That becomes a commitment. And in that way, you know, there's peace and trust and tranquility rather than constant kind of pushing and shoving and all that kind of stuff. So big difference in that, you know, and the activities that I do, those are just things that I add on. You know, some people say they can't plan that far ahead. You know, my kids always told me when they get ready to graduate from college, we don't know when graduation will be. Well, that's not true. Somebody at OU can tell you right now when the graduation will be in 09. They can tell you that. Because, my God, they don't do that at the last minute. They plan it like Rock Creek, you know. So, and I thought, you find out when it is, put it on the calendar. But otherwise, you're going to be getting that sheepskin by yourself. And so, I mean, it's just the real world. But when it's built on some solid foundation like that, it's hassle-free. It's hassle-free. And, you know, folks know what you're doing. I was blessed. I think I must have kissed the Blarney Stone or something. And I was best blessed in a lot of ways in my life. But I've noticed that blessings usually follow performance. And in my career, like most Fridays of my life, I'm gone. Yeah, most Fridays, I'm gone somewhere. And my organization, I mean, I'm just one of the beans on the stalk. But my organization did not have Friday meetings in respect for my schedule. Now, if they wanted to do Friday meetings, they did it without me. And they had no conflict. In 39 years, we never had conflict about that. And so it's the trustworthiness when people understand what you're doing, then it will have huge, huge influence. So when you... God, y'all's clocks run fast out here. That I think I've said the essence of what I want to say. Because when you look at the how to get these principles in place, and you start looking for things like balance, if you put them to work diligently in your life, practice good principles in how you manage your time, practice good principles in how you keep commitments to the family, and so when that happens, what I find, and I absolutely find it, is that AA does not compete with anything in my life. Nor has it ever had any negative impact on anything in my life. Rather, given this, just like I said last night, that giving my life to this simple program has absolutely blessed everything there. And so when you're looking for that balance, look a little deeper than just sort of how you write stuff down. Look a little deeper than just how you do all this stuff. You know, it really comes down, if you want to be of maximum service, if you really mean that, and that's not just some nice little thing to say in a meeting, if you really mean that, what it means is we give ourselves this simple program, and God is not going to get me into anything that's going to destroy one area of my life to enhance another. And I believe that, and I hope that that maybe a little bit of use in what we're talking about here this morning. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
We'll have